Impress your friends. Amaze your coworkers. Make your family proud. Here's what you need to know. I'm going to tell
you what you need to know. Brought to you by my friends at Robert Brogdon Buick GMC. Been voted the number one Buick dealer in the country, the number one volume GM dealer in the metro. Why? Brogdon gets you the best deal on the best vehicles. They do it in a timely fashion as well, not goofing around, leaving you in the showroom for 3 or 4 hours. No, they understand that your time is valuable, and they want to get you into your vehicle as quickly and efficiently as possible. See for yourself there at I-35 and Santa Fe. You can find them online at robertbrogdon.com. That's robertbrogdon.com, in person at I-35 in Santa Fe. All right, let's get things started here with some college basketball talk. The national championship, Baylor laying the beatdown last night. Their head coach, Scott Drew, said he wasn't surprised that his team was as good as they were on defense.
Well, prior to the pause, we were first top three in defense, and most of that time number one defense in the country. And we were solid three offense the whole time. And I know there was some let off when we came back, and then I thought we were getting it back. And, I mean, we're really good defensively. And I thought we made things tough tonight. Gonzaga missed some shots that they probably normally make. But really credit our guys for making everything difficult. Coach Jacobs was on their staff there and obviously familiar with the program. He had a great scouting report. But credit the players then for executing it.
They did have a great scouting report, and they did a fantastic job of just absolutely breaking down everything Gonzaga wanted to do. One of the best offensive teams, the best two-point efficiency team ever, and they made them look like it was, you know, they were playing the JVs out there. I mean,
yeah.
And think about this. Scott Drew was not known for his defense early on, right? They were a laughingstock defensively.
Right. You know, it is a lot of a scheme. You can't just do it on athletes alone, but I heard someone say, and they were discussing football, and I think they were describing Cornelius Bennett, of all things. He says, you know, you can point a guy in the right direction and tell him what to do, but some guys just get there faster than others. And that kind of – you can tell guys where to guard, but Davion Mitchell has physical skills that are not equaled by anybody else in the game today, and the other guys are pretty good, and so – it does help to have freak show athletes to execute that scheme. It was a combination of scheme and athletes last night. And as I said at one point, I tweeted out, I said, you know, watching Baylor play half-court offense is almost like athletic art.
I think Davion Mitchell may be the best on-ball defender I've seen.
Yeah.
And
it's crazy how good he is.
I know Kansas folks might get a little bit upset, but and it's not to say that, you know, somebody else is a really good player is not mean that you're taking away from anybody else that somebody else isn't any good. I think Marcus Garrett is a more versatile defender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you want to stop a point guard, I think I'll take Mitchell.
Yeah.
And I'll repeat it again. Scott Drew. I don't even know who the hell Mark Drew is. Scott Drew.
Mark Few and Scott Drew mixed together.
Yeah, I guess. Was laughed at for his defense for years in the Big 12. I mean, remember when they were just kind of like, hey, we recruit guys that don't even try, so we're just going to play a zone and try to be pretty big?
He broke that out for the Big 12 tournament when you didn't. We're like, wow, what is he doing? Okay.
It's like, well, we're not going to guard anybody, so let's at least, you know, I'll put the five tallest guys I can out there, and we'll roll with it. Let's see how this works.
And that Mitchell is also lightning quick with the ball, gets to the hole, can score at the basket with either hand, and shoots 43% whatever from three. I mean, I'm glad the rest of the country got to find out just how damn good he is.
What did you think of the officiating last night?
I thought it was okay. I saw some times where they seemed to let things go that should have been called, and I thought they called some fouls that probably shouldn't have been called. I mean,
I thought it was pretty good. You know what I think they got right is they never screwed up a block charge when a guy was standing in the circle, which I appreciate immensely. Yeah.
The one Vital was in the circle on the one, and they got it right. And fairly
no matter how upset he was.
Yeah, he was upset, but it was the right call. He was a foot inside. Both feet were clearly inside the circle.
They got Timmy the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, like, that's one of my more frustrating things is, like, they put the circle on the floor for you. You don't get to screw this one up anymore. And I still see it get screwed up a lot. They did not screw that up.
No.
Which is, you know, I think a step in the right direction.
I hope they let him play a little bit more last night than I think some people would have thought.
It wasn't the rugby match that Butler and Duke was.
Right.
You know, so I'll give him that. Scott Drew asked how his team was able to get off to such a fast start in both of their Final Four games.
Simple, player-led team. And those guys didn't want to lose for each other. They wanted to play for each other. And they're winners. They're experienced. They're tough. They love one another. You can't always know if you're going to make shots, but that's why the offensive board is so critical. And we finished 16-5 on the offensive glass and 16-5 in second chance points. And I thought Mark Vidal with 8 offensive rebounds was tremendous. But total team effort. We've had a starting rotation all year, 8 guys. And I think that wore on some teams, too, kept us fresher.
John Gassaway with us in the 3 o'clock hour. If you missed it, 810WHB.com with the podcast talking about it. And he said Baylor is one of his favorites. Scott Drew, one of his favorites because he has proven. Gassaway told us, you know, a number of years ago that shot volume is, one of the most important things that are out there. And they took 18 more shots than Gonzaga because they crashed the offensive glass and they forced the turnovers. But getting on that offensive glass, and he said they proved that you can be. He said so many coaches don't pound the offensive glass because they say, well, we don't want to get beat in transition going the other way. He said, well, Baylor doesn't get beat going the other way, and they pound the glass, which is something that I think a lot of people will imitate here moving forward.
And when you can go to Adam Flagler, Jonathan Chamwachachua, and Matthew Mayer off the bench, that's pretty good. Their starting five's good enough. When you bring those three guys out, man, that Gonzaga just wasn't deep enough to really withstand that. Once it got late, they didn't really have anybody to go to.
Yeah, no, they made Gonzaga look small, slow, and thin when it comes to the to the bench. Mark Few asked about how Baylor was able to get off to such a fast start.
They were just so much more aggressive than they literally just we haven't. Played like that this year. They just literally busted us out of anything we could possibly do on offense, and we were kind of playing with our back to the back, not facing up, and we couldn't get anything generated going to the basket. We were kind of playing sideways, and then at the other end they we had no answer as far as keeping some of their guards in front and made a couple of mistakes that we talked about not doing as far as giving them catch and shoot threes or shakedown threes, and they made us pay in a hurry.
How about that? We haven't played that hard all season.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I mean, if you heard that and it was December, you'd be like, okay, he's sending a message to the team through the media. But there's a lot of guys that aren't going to be playing for him next year. Like, what? We haven't, just flat out admitting Baylor plays harder than we've ever played.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of his answers, we've only put a couple, a lot of his answers were along the lines of that, the team they faced last night was something they had not seen before, and they just weren't prepared for it. They weren't ready for it.
Could you take that he's selling out his players?
I wouldn't put not in stone, but I see what you're saying. I mean, you put those dots aren't very far apart if you're trying to connect them. I mean, that certainly wasn't a compliment to their effort, that's for sure.
Right. I thought that really kind of stood out to me. Gary Parrish said on the Eye on CBS podcast that, Gonzaga really could have used that December game. That had they played in December, that this would have been a much better game because they would have known what they were in for. I think it'd have been a lot better for Few because he could have come up with a different game plan because his sucked. If he'd have seen just how outclassed he was athletically, then he, maybe the zone and hope they're not hitting is the way to go. Pack it in, take away the driving lanes, force Baylor to become one-dimensional, get the long rebounds, get out on your break. On that, maybe he does it a different way, but I thought, it could just be real honesty, and maybe that's what he's saying. I remember Rick Majerus sitting there after Utah lost the championship game to, I think, Bill Guthridge's North Carolina team, right? Guthridge won a championship there?
It was Kentucky in 98.
Kentucky, that's what it was.
Yeah, Kentucky.
And he sat there just distraught. He said, I've got to find a way to get more talented players. He said, our kids play hard. They play their guts out. And he said, but we just need another guy or two. And, like, you know, Rick Majerus, tremendous guy. But he basically just said, hey, a number of you guys just aren't talented enough.
Yeah.
And he said, I've got to help our guys out. Like, I've got to go find that NBA guy that I can sit there with all these other guys that we have. It was really, I just saw a guy, and he was kind of in tears mm-hmm. when he said it. And I thought it was just, you know, just a moment of pure honesty from Majerus. And I think that may have been what we heard from Mark Few there.
And he had Andre Miller, who was a good player, but Hannah Metallo was the next best guy, and they really didn't have much beyond that. Keith Van Horn had already been left by that time.
Yeah, he was gone. He was on the year before his team. But, yeah, I mean, just didn't maybe that's what we heard from Mark Few. North Carolina has a new coach. It's Hubert Davis. Their athletic director, Bubba Cunningham, was on ESPN today, explained why Hubert Davis was their next coach.
Great leader. He inspires the team. The kids connect with him. Great in player development. So I couldn't be more pleased with him and the direction of the program. The energy, the passion, the commitment, his own personality absolutely tipped me over the top, and he left, and I ended up calling the chancellor and said, I know who we're going to hire. I know who I want to recommend to hire. And fortunately, that was Hubert.
And Roy said he would do nothing to help us fundraise if we didn't take his guy.
Is that true?
I don't know, but doesn't that strike you as the kind of guy Roy is?
Yeah.
Fight for his guys no matter what? I mean, I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, when you said that, I didn't go, that's silly. Yeah. I went, did that happen? I mean, it's in the realm of possibility.
And Hubert Davis, having sat next to Roy Williams, is qualified for the job.
Sure.
Right? I don't have a – I mean, Chris Beard is who I would have gone for no matter who I was out there. I mean, once it became clear that there were going to be big jobs that could lure him away, I would have gone for Chris Beard. But Carolina likes to keep it in the family. We'll find out if it ends up being successful.
I also love the fact that the – athletic director at North Carolina's name is Bubba Cunningham. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
Bubba. Hey, Bubba.
All right. Io DeSumo.
Io DeSumo of the Illinois.
Yeah.
DeSumo.
Is going to the NBA draft. He's signing with an agent, so he will not be back. A little college basketball news there for you on that front. Barry Alvarez calling it quits as the athletic director at Wisconsin. He will retire in June. So after the whole academic year is over, then Barry Alvarez stepping down at Wisconsin. So I think that's of note. A little baseball news for you. The Yankees finalizing a trade for Rougned Odor from the Rangers, this according to Jeff Passan. And the Nationals finally got on the field today. They've been battling COVID issues. Announcing today, Patrick Corbin and John Lester, two starting pitchers, catchers Yan Gomes and Alex Avila, first baseman Josh Bell, infielder Josh Harrison and Jody Mercer, infielder Kyle Schwarber, left fielder Kyle Schwarber, and reliever Brad Hand have all been placed on the injured list with no specified injury. It appears every one of those guys, COVID. The pandemic is getting better. The vaccines are safe and working. Please get them as soon as you can. But it is not over. Also, the headline today in the Indianapolis paper, St. Elmo's, the famous steakhouse, had a COVID outbreak after having the NCAA tournament there. St. Elmo's is closed now after a COVID outbreak. And the bartender a real popular guy, dead of COVID.
Wow.
I don't say that flippantly. I say that to mean that things are getting better. It is not over. So the Nationals, 11 guys not able to play. Everybody, not a maximum amount of people in Indianapolis, but enough that one of the most popular restaurant in Indianapolis has a massive COVID outbreak and the bartender died. So still work to be done before we are completely behind us. All right, one more. This one I just love. See if you can figure out why I love this. Adam Schefter on ESPN this morning, NFL insider here in the program. He was asked what the Jets might do with their other first-round pick at number 23.
This team still has to go out and add offensive playmakers and offensive linemen. And I would think that knowing Joe Douglas's history, that priority one is going to be protecting Zach Wilson. And so I don't know if that means you're going to go out and take double offensive linemen with those two picks, or an offensive lineman and a wide receiver, or an offensive lineman and a running back. But they're going to surround Zach Wilson with talent, and the first thing they're going to do in my mind is protect him. I'll be surprised if the Jets don't come out of this draft with at least one and maybe multiple offensive linemen. It's just what they're going to do. They're going to start building around the quarterback, and they're going to put a high degree of priority on protecting him to the fullest.
I just love the phrase, the Jets are going to start building around the quarterback. I mean, tape delayed to the West Coast. Late to the party. Building around the quarterback. Isn't that one that like ought to be built in? Like you already got that, you know, you already got it figured out.
And also, I mean, coming from a team that just had the opportunity to do that and didn't.
Yeah. So they'll go Wilson with the quarterback at two, and then they will build around him after that. Sounds like a smart plan. Let me know how it works out with the Jets. We will take a break. We'll talk some NFL draft. The guy does a great job breaking it down. Matt Manicieri at SIS Handbook, the editor of the SIS Handbook, former NFL scout, joins us next here in the program.
The program with Soren Petro.
It wouldn't stay up. It would stay down. Yeah. It never froze in the up position.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
You're listening to the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB, creeping ever closer to the NFL draft. Let's break it down right now with Matt Manicharian from the SIS Handbook, former NFL scout. He joins us via our T-Mobile guest line. He's brought to you by our friends at Easton Roofing. Easton Roofing handles both commercial and residential roofing projects. No payment is collected until you're 100% satisfied. Find them online at eastonroofing.com. Easton Roofing, getting you back to life, getting you back to business faster. That's Easton Roofing, online at eastonroofing.com. Matt, how are you, my friend? Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
Let's start with how this draft ranks to other drafts, depth-wise, overall, just total quantity of talent. Is this a deep draft? Is it deeper than last year's draft? How would you evaluate it overall?
Yeah, super interesting question coming off 2020. I would say it's not deep at all, but there's still really good talent on the front end. So because we saw so many players that have the option to return to school without having it hurt their eligibility, so many people that didn't even play this past season, we see that there are less players in the total pool, which means as we get deep into day three and into undrafted free agency, we're going to be very thin relative to a normal year. Now, all that said, the top of this draft, we know it's a very quarterback-strong draft. Everybody's talked about that. We have maybe as strong a receiver draft as we had last year, which we thought was the strongest receiver draft ever, perhaps at the time. And you get pretty good depth through the top 100, through the first three rounds. It's day three where you start to see things drop off.
All right, so that would mean that this would be a draft that you'd want to trade up in, right? Because down at the bottom, and I'm not saying necessarily give all your picks to get up to, 10 spots higher in round one, but if you see guys that you like in round one, two, or three, and you got to give up fours, fives, sixes, and sevens to go get them, that would seem to be a prudent move based upon how you think the depth lays out in this draft.
Yeah, I would say in general, I'm sort of against what you just mentioned. I don't like giving up picks to move up. But if there was ever a year to do that, I think you can make a good case that this is the year to do so. My issue is I think teams are already jacked up to begin with in how they value draft picks in different rounds. I think people already overvalue the high picks, so maybe it's closer to a wash this year for me personally.
Okay, that's good to know. I do too. I think, they're lottery tickets. You have to understand that there's no such thing as a sure thing. So the more picks you have, the better chance you have of having a good draft. So I'm with you. But we're sitting in Kansas City where the general manager has built a world championship, or at least finished off a world championship, and was part of the group that helped lay the foundation for it. And he has had three drafts and he hasn't traded down once. And so, I know what to expect if he does what he's done in the past, although I don't think he traded up last year off the top of my head. Maybe he did once somewhere late. Oh, yeah, he did, because he traded this year's sixth for last year's seventh. to go get Bo Peep Keys. So he did trade up, traded back into the draft last year to get Bo Peep Keys. So he did make a trade last year. But I'm just getting ready for if he does that, this might be a year that it's a little more acceptable in the eyes.
Hey, but
if you look at
that move individually, this is at the beginning of the pandemic. If he had the foresight to realize that it was going to be thinner this year relative to a normal year and say, hey, I'll take a 7 this year instead of a 6 next year, that goes back to what we were just talking about. So I think that does make sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Absolutely. All right. Let's talk about the offensive tackles. I think that's the spot if the Chiefs, unless they can find a veteran offensive tackle, I don't know that they have a guy that they would feel real comfortable protecting the blind side of Patrick Mahomes at left tackle. That's a dangerous spot to be in. It's one that the Chiefs usually aren't in. They generally do a pretty good job of being ready to take the field before the draft ever happens and then trying to take best player available. Everybody has some need in mind, but they're not in that spot this year. I think they have to go get a left tackle. How many of the tackles out there do you feel comfortable are good enough to start at left tackle in the NFL year one?
So year one is the really tough part of the question there. So the way we grade players in the handbook is the way that I learned to grade players as an NFL scout, which is we grade them for what they're going to be the first day of their second season. Now, the exception to that is when you have the all-pro level players. We have Penei Sewell graded out as an all-pro, which means day one starter, day one difference maker. Aside from that, I'd feel comfortable plugging Rashawn Slater in on day one. I don't think he's going to be available for the Chiefs either. So the group of players that you start to get into is Christian Darrisaw, Liam Eichenberg, Samuel Cosmi, and Jalen Mayfield. Those four guys, we grade them out as starters by the first game of their second year. When you're a little bit of a tackle-needy team, I think you might need to plug some of those guys in early. I think each of them has some strong upside, and they legitimately are NFL starting-level tackles. But I do think that each of them does have some different warts. I think Eichenberg is limited in terms of his upside, for example. I think when you look at somebody like Mayfield out of Michigan, with him, he's really started 15 games at Michigan over a short three seasons there. So with such a young player who's not even 21 as he's going to be drafted, not even old enough to drink, at least legally, to see what that guy's going to be, you know, I get a little nervous for day one. I get excited about the upside, but that's what you're dealing with. You know, you're not in the top half of the first round. You know, everybody's got a wart somewhere.
Do you like the depth at tackle if they don't end up going with one in the first round and it's the second round, it's the third round? Are there guys that you think have upside?
Yes, I do. We've got a few guys graded out. Aside from those guys that I've mentioned, we've got three more tackles that grade out as kind of like low-end starters, guys that I wouldn't be super excited to plug in and start right away. But, you know, if you look at a team like the Miami Dolphins last year, who were supposedly very offensive line needy, they were able to plug in these third and fourth round level guys and get starts out of them throughout the year. So I don't think that that's an unreasonable thing to look for. When you look at a guy like James Hudson, a guy like Walker Little, these are not the names that you're hearing Kiper talk about every day, you know, when you're on ESPN. But when you look at Walker Little, I think that's a guy that's a stronger pass protector than he is a run blocker. So I think there's some kind of plug and play with him there, even though I think the upside is slightly more limited. You can make some cases. There could be some guys that are interesting fits for them there.
Yeah, I like, and I actually saw it. It's funny you mentioned that. I saw Walker Little's name thrown by the Chiefs in the second round as a guy that could fit for them. So that's, I can't remember where I saw it, but I was looking through a number of mock drafts and I saw that one. You mentioned the wide receiver class. We're talking to Matt Manoogian, here, former NFL scout, now the editor of SIS Football Rookie Handbook. Great draft guide to have with you for watching the NFL draft. You mentioned the wide receivers, and again, you kind of mentioned Mel talking about certain tackles, right? And we can talk about the quarterbacks as well. It's the five quarterbacks everyone mentions. There's three wideouts that everybody talks about: Devonta Smith, Ja'Marr Chase, Jaylen Waddle. First of all, just for fantasy players, which one of those three do you think is going to be the best?
Ooh, from a fantasy perspective, tell me what team they get on.
That's true. I mean, just who's going to be the best? Which one's the best of those three? Forget about what they'll score points wise, but you know, Kansas City, we know that none of those three are going to be there for the Chiefs. Which one though do you think will end up being the best one of the bunch?
Yeah, I love all three of them, and that's a really tough question for me. If you asked me a year ago, I would have told you it's Ja'Marr Chase, don't even think about it. And then somehow without a year of him playing football, the two Alabama guys get them into the equation. We have Waddle ranked as the top guy out of the three of them, and the reason for that is that he's got that freaky type of speed that you know, I don't like to mention names like this in comps, but he's got that Tyreek Hill type of speed and the ability to sort of adjust his speed on the fly where you think he's running at full speed, and then all of a sudden he's really running at full speed, and that results in 6 points, as you guys know all, you know, all too well in Kansas City. So he's the top guy just because he's the only guy that we rated with truly, truly elite speed. That said, I absolutely love Ja'Marr Chase. I would have a hard time if I was on the clock picking anybody above Ja'Marr Chase. And I think from a fantasy standpoint, he's a little bit more bulletproof because he's a little bit more of a red zone contested ball threat. And you look for guys that are going to score touchdowns rather than create yards, I would probably say. So if I'm projecting touchdowns, give the advantage to Chase. If I'm projecting yards, give the advantage to Waddle. And then, you know, all Devontae Smith did was have the best receiving season in college football history last year. So whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Who are the wide receivers that could creep into the bottom of the first round? Who else do you think will go in the first round? Kadarius Toney at Florida, Terrence Marshall at LSU. Who are the other guys that you think could be first round wideouts that maybe are there towards the end of the first?
Yeah, I think Toney could go because he can run. And when you can run, even though we think he's limited to being more of a slot player, kind of a gadget type guy. Marshall's a guy that you see him on a lot of the charts as somebody that could go off. Rashad Bateman, I think, is a guy to keep an eye on. Good size, kind of really good all-around player right there. And Dwayne Eskridge is a guy, Rondale Moore. These are some of the names of the players that I could see being around there, more kind of the bottom half of the first round. If I'm being real smart, though, if I can't get my hands on one of those top three guys, I might sit tight and wait until later in the draft because I mentioned it's going to thin out. It's not going to thin out at receiver anytime soon. So if you're at day three thinking about a receiver, you might be able to pick amongst somebody that you really like just because there are enough receivers to go around, honestly.
So does that mean that they slide and it gets even deeper? Because teams keep doing that and say, well, we'll get a receiver in the next round. We'll get a receiver in the next round. And all of a sudden you're getting second-round value in the fourth round?
I think that it's possible. I think that what ends up happening if you've been in enough draft rooms is you see all the positions thin out except for running back and wide receiver. And we've seen running backs become devalued. Wide receiver has been a little bit more resilient because the passing has been so emphasized in the NFL. But I think if you've been in enough of those rooms, you know what scarcity is. And if you look at free agency this year, you'll notice that the receivers weren't getting the big contracts. It was all the offensive linemen, teams realizing that they needed to shore up front rather than spend money on luxury players with the salary cap shrinking. I think you could see a similar sort of thing happen in the draft. Where because teams realize that the way this draft shakes out, if they need an offensive lineman, they've got to go get him early. If they need an edge rusher, they've got to go get him early. If you start to think about the opportunity cost of things, it does make sense to wait. Now, the thing that goes against that is there are just so many receivers that it's going to be tantalizing because once you get, almost wherever you are in the draft, whether you're in the middle of the first round, second round, third round, the guys are always going to be graded above what round you're in, right? You're going to have second-round grades when you're in the third round. You're going to have third-round grades when you're in the fourth round. So it's just going to keep getting more and more tantalizing the more patient you can be as a decision-maker on draft day.
I was told that there's one tight end in this whole class. I would love for there to be a really good young tight end available in the third round where the Chiefs got, Travis Kelce. And I'd love to see him pair a young tight end with Kelce. I think Andy Reid likes to do a lot of two tight end sets, but I don't think he's really had a second tight end ever really here with the Chiefs, yet he still runs the two tight end sets. Do you agree with what I was told, that there's Pitts and then there's no one else to really get excited about, or is there a guy you like?
I'd say there's Pitts and then there's everybody else, which is more a reflection on Pitts than anything else. The guy's absolutely outrageous. He's unlike any tight end prospect I've graded in the last several years. But the guy that's number two for me and the other guy that we have graded as somebody that could turn into a solid starting level player is Pat Freiermuth out of Penn State. He's a guy that is coming off injury, so we've got the medical flag on him. But in terms of what he can be as a tight end, no, he's not Travis Kelce. He doesn't have that sort of upside. What he is a balanced guy that can be the true blocking tight end, that can do stuff as an H-back in your system, that can find the open spot, the soft spot in zone coverage, that gets it done in the blocking game. He's got that versatility that you look for, kind of an old-school throwback-style tight end in that way, not the mismatch freak that you look at with a Kelce or a Pitts. But in terms of complementing a Kelce or a Pitts, I think that if he was there on day two for me, I would be excited about Freiermuth at that point.
Okay. You mentioned the defensive ends. You said you're going to have to go early or probably not at all. Who are the ones that are worth going early on, and where does it begin to fall off?
Yeah, well, there's no real true early guys. There's no Chase Young that we have graded as a Pro Bowler. But we do have seven guys with that strong starter-level grade, and it's led by Jalen Phillips out of Miami. I think that he's going to come off the board somewhere around the teens in the first round. And from there, you start to see that I think there'll be a run on kind of these guys that are all probably starting level pass rushers, but almost like I was talking about before with tackles, there's each of them has some sort of a wart. There's not a perfect player there. So you have an Azizu Ojulari and a Kwity Paye. These guys are really good athletes that slot in with a lot of upside. But you see things like limited amount on film, you know, Ojulari being a third-year sophomore and having two right ACL injuries. You see a Kwity Paye, and you see all the first-step explosion in the world, but the repertoire isn't there in terms of what he is as a pass rusher. So you start to get these guys, and I think those two guys, a Rashad Weaver out of Pitt, a guy that's been really, really productive, but I think he's kind of tapped out in terms of upside. I don't think he has much growth potential. He's the exact opposite of a Gregory Rousseau out of Miami, who's all upside and growth potential. But man, you could see it going the wrong way for him too. He's a boomer bust. All of these guys and Quincy Roche and Jason Oweh, those are the guys that those are the top seven. Where I'd say if you don't make a move on those guys by the end of the second round, I don't think you're getting any of them. And then, you know, you get a Carlos Basham, and then you really start to drop off into more depth-level players than guys that are truly, you know, starters for an NFL team that are kind of upgrading your pass rush.
A Steve Spagnuolo defensive end tends to be a long, lean type of guy. Gregory Rousseau looks that part from Miami, but like you said, I don't think he's going to be there at 31, and I don't know that the Chiefs can take anything but a tackle at 31. But a guy I was looking at that you know maybe is all ceiling or maybe not, Deo Odeyingbo from Vanderbilt. He's got that long frame, looks fairly explosive, but seems to be somewhat of a raw player, at least what I've read. You know, to me, is he a guy that could be there round two, round three, that might fit that kind of Steve Spagnuolo D end?
Yeah, I think he can be there, and I think you sum it up. He's got some of those traits that you look for. You know, I was with Spags in New Orleans. We overlapped for a year there. And one thing that I know is you got to be smart to play in his scheme. You really have to do, even if you're on the defensive line, you're not always going to be attacking. You know, you're going to have these zone reads and drops like that where you've got to be able to understand what the stunts are doing, understand how going from a two-back to a one-back formation is going to change your responsibility. So I look for intelligence and guys that can play with versatility as well as those requisite physical traits that you talked about. So it's not an easy position. It's not an easy position to be really good at, but that's why when you find one of those guys, they get paid a lot of money.
Yeah, Vanderbilt would seem to speak to the fact that the kid ought to be pretty bright if he would be the guy. Anthony Hitchens is going to be, I think this will be his last year with the Chiefs. His contract just gets a lot more cuttable after this year. I think middle linebacker is a spot they'd like to go. I know Micah Parsons is this heat-seeking missile. He's going to go very high. Who are the next couple of middle linebackers, and where do you think they start coming off the board?
First guy out of Notre Dame, Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, he's just a classic Will linebacker, just made for the modern NFL, almost like a Derrick Brooks for today's game. I don't think he's that quality of a player, but certainly he's going to come in. He's going to be a strong starter for a team, somebody that has speed, coverage ability. That's what you really need to excel as an off-ball linebacker in today's NFL. You've got to be able to cover running backs and tight ends, or else you're getting played off of the field for these nickel and dime and all of those kind of sets. So he's a guy that, you know, as an off-ball linebacker, can do a lot of different things, brings versatility. He can even go out and guard over the slot at different times. He can get in and rush a little bit. So I really like him. I go back to Alabama. They've got Dylan Moses, one of their guys coming out this year, another really strong player. He was coming off an injury this past season, so we saw him play. He kind of wasn't at full strength relative to what he might have been if he had kind of continued on his progression without getting injured. But again, a guy that you put on your team, either of these two guys, they're going to make your entire defense faster by being on your team. So we look for that play speed, that coverage ability. He's got what you're talking about, especially if he can get back to the player that he was on track to be before that ACL injury. So those are a couple of the top guys that I really love at linebacker. Zaven Collins out of Tulsa, also a really interesting prospect. Jabril Cox out of LSU, somebody that I think will be there on day two, who just really excellent, excellent statistics across the board. When you start to break down the advanced stats on him, what kind of our bread and butter is at Sports Info Solutions. He had a 99 out of 99 coverage grade in 2020 this past year. So when you talk about linebackers that get it done in all three phases, he's certainly one of those guys.
Is linebacker becoming one of the positions that's hardest to find because everybody's in four wide and doing that, and linebackers are coming off the field that there just aren't any, you know, there's just fewer guys playing the position now, so it makes it more difficult to find them?
Well, it's more difficult to find, but you need fewer of them, right? So if you're talking 1990s football, you need three linebackers to be in there on every down unless it's third and long, and then you bring the nickel back in. You got to make sure that you have a bunch of these guys to play for you. At this point in the NFL, it's kind of like pass rushers and coverage players, and we only really care about linebackers so far as we need to care about them because, you know, first and second downs still happen, even if they don't matter as much as third downs and sort of what you can do in the passing game. So there are fewer linebackers that I think fit in the modern NFL, but they're almost more like what we used to look for in strong safeties when we were talking about, the football that I grew up with. So it's just sort of been a whole big metamorphosis where, like in basketball, you talk about positionless basketball and you have point forwards and stuff like this. When you talk about NFL football, that's where we're getting right now, where we need guys that can cover man coverage, and we need them to be able to guard all five positions, right? So we need somebody who can guard the wide receivers. We've had corners doing that, but now we need somebody to guard Kyle Pitts. We need somebody who can guard the power forward, and we need somebody who can guard the point guard and go match up with Christian McCaffrey, whether he's in the backfield or out wide. And that's the chess game that keeps happening. So I always start thinking about more and more, yeah, linebackers are harder to find, but what is a linebacker? And we're kind of really entering this positionless era of defensive football, I think out of necessity, because offenses are just so far ahead right now with the rules and the way they've developed. You've got to kind of have that interchangeability. And these Swiss Army knife players, whether we call them linebackers, safeties, overhangs, those are the guys that I think become the Swiss Army knife type of chess piece that helps neutralize some of these crazy matchups threats that you have on offense.
It's called the SIS Football Rookie Handbook. Matt Manoogian is with us. He is the editor, a former NFL scout, who breaks down the entire draft for you. Great guy to have handy on draft day. Time for our final four quickies. It's brought to you by the University of Kansas Health System. You can make an appointment right now at kansashealthsystem.com/sportsmedicine. I will start you with this. When you watch the draft, ESPN or the NFL Network?
NFL Network, hands down, no doubt about it.
Okay. What's the draft food you got to have?
Wings. Wings and beer for me every time.
I love it. That's a classic. All right. Give me a bust in this year's draft.
I have to go with one bust. We were talking about the linebackers a minute ago, and I think it could be Micah Parsons, and I think it all depends on where he ends up. It reminds me a little bit, help me out with the name, the guy who came out of Temple and went to the Arizona Cardinals a couple of years ago. You have to have a vision for these sorts of players that could be a linebacker. Hassan Reddick could be a linebacker, yep. Could be a pass rusher. We're not sure exactly what he is. Micah Parsons is a little bit of that. He's a really good pass rusher, so you're going to want to use him in that way. And I think if you find the right usage for him, he could be the next Devin White, the linebacker from Tampa Bay that yep. We saw in the Super Bowl, pass rushing, making plays all over the place, heat-seeking missile. But if he gets into the wrong sort of thing where they're not sure exactly how they want to use him, I worry about this player getting confused because in coverage, he's a guy that can get lost. And we just talked about coverage and how much I care about coverage and those Swiss Army knives. If this guy's just a pass rusher, then he's undersized as just a pass rusher. So that's where I see there's some real boom, but also some real bust potential.
All right, then give me a sleeper in this year's draft.
Sorry to do this, sir, because we just brought him up, but the guy that I wanted to talk about was Dylan Moses, the linebacker out of Alabama. Nobody is talking about him. It drives me absolutely crazy. He's nowhere on anybody's radars. I know he had the injury, and he wasn't exactly the same player that he was coming back from the injury, but I ask people, turn on the film. Tell me what you see with this guy in terms of where you see the holes in his game. I think he's going to be a starting linebacker. Somebody's going to be thrilled to get him on the second day of the draft. I can't believe that he's got no first-round buzz whatsoever.
Yeah, he was like a giant. Like everyone was talking about him being the best linebacker in college football. Then he gets hurt, and if he's not quite what he was, then you'd expect him to be 100% the second year removed from the injury, right?
Yeah. I think what happened when you look at the film is, yeah, he wasn't playing at the level that he was playing before, but I think that Nick Saban said some things in the media about being disappointed with that. And then I think you start to look, if you look at his draft stock over time, that's when things started to turn. And I think there's been a bit of an overreaction to kind of maybe Saban souring on his performance a little bit. Whereas if you actually watch the film, it doesn't really match that narrative as strongly as you would think.
Yeah, interesting. Matt, always great talking to you. Great stuff. Always a great breakdown. I'm a big fan of the book, too, the SIS Football Rookie Handbook. It's a great guide to have with you when you're watching the draft or getting ready for the draft, so I encourage everybody to get it. What's the easiest way to get the book?
You can get the book at actasports.com. That's actasports.com. And it's also available on Amazon. We have a Kindle edition for the first time this year, so you can get it wherever you get your books, but the Kindle on Amazon is certainly convenient.
Yeah, very good. Matt, thanks so much, buddy. Thank you for the time, and have yourself a great draft season.
Hey, thanks for having me. Take care.
You bet. Matt Manoogian, SIS Football Rookie Handbook. That is the guide if you want a great resource tool at your fingertips on draft day. We will take a break, come back, give you the kicker next.
The Program with Soren Petro.
Travis?
Hey, how are you? All right. Happy Wednesday, everybody.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB. We're almost done for the day, but there's just a few more things we'd like to share.
But there's still more.
Here's the kicker.
Here's the kicker of this whole thing.
On the Program.
But first, a good sense into the hour answer. How many teams have beaten an undefeated opponent in the national championship game? 3. Baylor over Gonzaga this year, Michigan State over Indiana State in 79, and Cincinnati over defending champion Ohio State in 1961.
I was wondering what that was. I could get 2. I'm like, there has to be more than just 2. So, good stuff. I like it. Good Sense. That's great stuff. Good Sense. You can get it at GoodSenseSubs.com. Get it with the app. That's the easiest way to order. Make sure you're part of the loyalty club. 10% back. It's the best loyalty club in town. It is at your neighborhood Good Sense. Scott Drew is a champion. We will leave you with this. Think about all the times you thought the guy was an idiot. Or many people thought he was an idiot. Maybe you individually never did. And now he's come all the way to have not just a winning team, but a dominant team. Listen, even if you're the worst coach in the Big 12, you're one of the best basketball coaches in the world, right? That's something to understand. And if you're good enough to get one of those jobs, sometimes, you know, guys aren't good enough to hold on to those jobs. But if you're good enough to get it, there's a decent chance that you're good enough to get better. There's no doubt Scott Drew has morphed and changed and grown in time with the